It's time to bring in Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Arthur joins us on a Monday morning, and we talk about food, even on the 4th of July. Good morning, Arthur.
What do you mean, even on the 4th of July?
Especially,
on the 4th of July. I have a real food tradition for the 4th of July, and that is to make my old and long-deceased friend Bert Green's ziti salad. It is one of my oldest friends, and I made it several years ago, and brought it to my nephews for a barbecue, and my niece dubbed it crack salad because it is so addictive. However, I only make it once a year, and that's for the 4th of July. And I'm going to quickly tell you what the recipe is. You can find this recipe on the internet it's always credited to Bert Green. Fortunately, it's one of those few recipes that actually is credited by most people to Bert Green. But it's really just fancy macaroni salad. It's ziti instead of elbow macaroni, which is the typical American product. And let me just see here. I'm looking in my cabinet. And it has a number of vegetables, sweet bell peppers, tomato, it's got dill. But the essential secret ingredient, and here it is G. Washington's rich brown seasoning and broth, which is basically a lot of salt. The number one ingredient in this is salt. The second ingredient is MSG. The third is some chemical I never heard of. And then there's another chemical. So I don't know where the rich brown comes from, but it has a very particular taste. And my story about, I have two packets left, and if I made a whole recipe, which is a whole pound of macaroni, I would need to use these two packets. But I meant to make this a number of years ago, and I couldn't find G. Washington in my supermarket. So I went to another supermarket, and then another supermarket. And then finally, I said to a cashier I was friendly with, I said, can you imagine I can't find this product anywhere? And she said, that's because you shop in a rich neighborhood. You got to go to a poor neighborhood to find that product. But I ended up buying it at some crazy price on the internet. So I have two packets left. And, so what else is in it? Oh, if you read about this on the internet, some people will say it's the G. Washington that makes it taste addictive. And other people will tell you, and I think they're wrong, but it's an essential ingredient in this recipe, is the sweet gherkin juice. The recipe calls for 6 sweet gherkins. You know, those are the tiny sweet pickles, and you dice them up. But then you also have to use 1 tablespoon of the pickle juice. So it's, and it's your normal kind of, well, maybe not so normal, because it's part mayonnaise and then a small part sour cream. It's not all mayonnaise. Anyway, if you go on the internet, you get Bert Green's ziti salad, and I did not make it yet, by the way. I've been resisting, but then I remembered just this morning, because I don't think I want to eat macaroni in the form of a macaroni salad. If I'm going to have pasta, I'm going to eat an Italian pasta dish. But I did make this dressing. I should give you the dressing recipe, shouldn't I?
Yes.
So I made this dressing at the height of my keto diet as a dressing to go on a coleslaw. I decided, it's good on macaroni salad. It's probably good on shredded cabbage. And it was, but, not the same satisfaction. Not the same crack value as on macaroni salad. And then I made it as a dressing for a wedge of iceberg lettuce. That was very good, too. I liked that. It was novel, and it was colorful because it's not just a white dressing. So here's... Now, by the way, in this recipe, I want to get to some other things, so I'm going to go through this quickly. But I always... Bert passed away before I could ask him this question, is where did he get this milk, this little technique of taking hot pasta and soaking it in cold milk, because it's a thing that Neapolitans do. That not necessarily milk, it could be some, you know, cold tomato sauce, whatever. But in other words, once the pasta's cooked, you have to dress it with something that's all going to stick together. And also, if you're baking, this would be for a baked pasta dish in Naples, if you're going to bake the pasta and it's going to cook further, it's going to absorb more of the moisture. So you soak it first a little bit. So in this, you cook up a pound of ziti and drain it well. You can rinse it if you want, but you don't need to, because you're going to put it in a bowl with a quarter of a cup of milk, and you're going to toss it in the cold milk, and then every couple of minutes while you're doing everything else, you'll toss it in the cold milk. And then the dressing itself is a medium red onion diced. I would dice it small. Two tomatoes, fresh salad tomatoes, medium tomatoes, also cubed. Six sweet pickles, gherkins, minced. A sweet red pepper. Well, you know, you can do any color peppers you want. I usually do two red peppers. But if you want to make it even more colorful, 4th of July, a red pepper and a yellow pepper, also diced. A large shallot, which ends up being quite a lot of shallot, a large shallot. I would say you got a third of a cup of minced shallots. A half a cup of sour cream. 1.5 cups of mayonnaise. 2 packets of G. Washington. A quarter of a teaspoon. That's not enough. A half a teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper. A dash of vinegar. Could be balsamic, could be red wine vinegar, could be white wine vinegar, could be apple cider vinegar, any vinegar. In the end, you're going to add more than a dash, I'm sure, because I would. And then a tablespoon of the sweet pickle juice. Also, and this is the fresh herb, you can do all this ahead, and actually you can do the whole thing ahead and keep it in the fridge, a good handful, or even more, of chopped fresh dill. So you just mix it all up and it goes on the macaroni, and I don't like to dress mine too far ahead. Good dish. So I'm visiting old friends. That's a tradition already. But the other day I picked up, I don't even remember why I picked up, my copy of Giuliano Bujali's first cookbook, The Fine Art of Italian Cooking. Very, very sadly, not many people remember Giuliano, unless they studied with him in Italy. You know, his books always sold well, too. But I think his first book, as I said, The Fine Art of Italian Cooking, probably sold better. It came out around the same time, and Giuliano was teaching at the same time that Marcello Hazan was, and they were big competitors. Marcello was my friend, but Giuliano was actually my close friend. And I would tell them this to their face, that this is not the fine art of Italian cooking. This is the fine art of Tuscan cooking. Giuliano was from Florence. He was a very proud Florentine, very proud Tuscan. I got to say, almost stereotypically Tuscan. He totally immersed in Italian, Florentine, Tuscan food history. And that's how I met him, because in my early 20s, I went on a trip with some friends visiting wineries in Chianti. And the Chianti Association, so to speak, set us up with having dinner at the home of Giuliano Bujali, who had yet to publish a book, but was doing things like this, making Renaissance dinners for a price for both the regional tourist association, VIPs, blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, he was researching and testing recipes for the eventual cookbook, The Fine Art of Italian Cooking, and he was just beginning. This is, I guess, the early 70s. No, mid-70s. Well, it could be early 70s. Mid-70s, anyway. Just beginning to teach. Eventually, he became a hugely successful Italian cooking teacher. Not in his home, but in a... I guess you'd call it... he remade it into a teaching kitchen loft space in Florence, just in the heart of the city. And so, of course, that was another attraction. You got to spend a week in Florence. And Giuliano was extremely charming, extremely knowledgeable, always was touting Tuscan cuisine as the sort of mother cuisine of French cuisine. In fact, just this morning, I looked at a recipe in the book, and he was discussing eggs Florentine, which he points out is not at all Florentine, and is probably French, but of course, in Giuliano's point of view is the French got everything from the Italians. It all goes back to Caterina de' Medici, who became Queen of France in, I forget what, 15-something. Anyway, I'm thumbing through Giuliano's book, and I'm visiting recipes that I haven't made in 30 years, or maybe even more. But these were the recipes that I was, so to speak, weaned on in Italian food, because Giuliano and I, after that initial dinner in his home in Florence, and he lived part-time in New York. I don't know how many months and months, but he taught in Florence. Eventually, he taught in Manhattan, one of those 80-something street, one of the streets that lead into the Metropolitan Museum, a very chic location, which he also redid as to make it look like he was in Florence. And then he moved downtown to Soho and did the same thing. Anyway, one of the recipes, there were two recipes in here that I used to make all the time. And one I didn't make. Let's start with that one. I didn't make over the weekend because it was so hot and I didn't want to turn the oven on, but I've been wanting to make a sformata. A sformata is it's a vegetable. Made into, you bake it in a, with bechamel, and that has eggs and cheese in it, and you can unmold it and slice it and serve it, and it's, I guess you'd say elegant, you know, it's fancy anyway, it's not just steamed vegetables, but I've been wanting to do it, but I have to wait till a day where the oven could be on for a couple hours. And the other thing is a dish that I remember made. I had forgotten all about it. This happens until I saw it in the book. It's chicken cooked on top of the stove with almonds and fennel. And what triggered my memory about this recipe is that I got to find it here. Although I could tell you off the top of my head. What triggered it is that at the end of the recipe, Giuliano says, and it's very good cold. And I remembered making this as a summer dish because it is good cold. And you just take, let me say, every ingredient here is important. As in most Italian cooking, there's not that many ingredients, but everyone should be prime. You take a red onion, a medium red onion, diced. He says coarsely chopped. I do like quarter-inch dice. And pancetta, 4 ounces of pancetta. And I had some very good pancetta in the house. I do think any recipe that calls for pancetta, the quality of the pancetta is all important. However, there are products sold in the supermarkets these days of diced pancetta. Citerio is a main brand, but there are other brands, and I would, in a pinch, definitely use one of these. And each one of those boxes is 4 ounces. So you need one whole box, little box of this. And it's already very finely diced. I don't dice mine as finely as that when I'm doing it by hand, but that's okay, too. And I did do it by hand, 4 ounces. It doesn't amount to all that much. Put a little olive oil, I would say a couple tablespoons of olive oil, in a casserole. Add your pancetta, and when it starts rendering out, you get more fat in the bottom of the pan. Add your diced red onion and saute it until the onion is tender. This takes a little time, like maybe 8 minutes, 10 minutes. If it's browning right away, that means the heat's way too high. You don't want this, you know, to be on high heat. Then you take your chicken. I used 6 chicken thighs, amounting to a little less than 3 pounds of chicken. I have a pan that holds 8, and I guess I could stretch this to make 8 thighs. Of course, Giuliano uses a whole chicken cut up into pieces. I like it this way. And you're not going to really get the chicken brown. What I do is I push the onion and pancetta aside and start putting the chicken thighs down, skin side down. Keep moving around the pancetta and onion. You can put some of it on top of the thigh that you already have with the skin side down, until you've done them all. And it usually takes maybe 6 or 7 minutes, and you're going to get not so much brown as colored. Make sure you jiggle the chicken at this point to make sure it's not sticking, and keep going, and then turn over the chicken and cook the other side 2 or 3 minutes, not a whole lot, because now you're really going to cook the chicken. You're basically stiffening up the proteins here. You're not going to end up with a brown chicken dish. It's going to be white, flabby skin at the end, which you can either eat or not. I invited my neighbor over, and she's usually picky about those things, but she had no problem with the skin. Anyway, you could, on your plate, take it off if it bothers you. But certainly the chicken will taste better if it's cooked with it on. So then you put in 2 cups of chicken broth. I happen to have really good chicken broth because I'd made the moussakan less than a week before, and I saved the broth that resulted, which was really good, skimmed it, so it was a lean broth, and I 2 cups, and I put that in the pan with the chicken with, now Giuliano says to combine this in a separate pan, so I did. I heated up my 2 cups of broth with 4 ounces of blanched almonds, whole blanched almonds. Can you make this with slivered almonds? Sure. Can you make this with sliced almonds? I suppose. But the whole point of the almonds here is that if they're not giving up much flavor, they're the crunch in the dish, which a nice textural, you know, contrast. And a heaping tablespoon, the main flavoring, a heaping tablespoon of fennel seed. As everybody may remember or may not, I was growing wild fennel next to my house here in Brooklyn, and I collected a huge amount of fennel seed. It's several years already, so it does have flavor, but I decided I better buy some fresh fennel seed and just see the difference. And sure enough, of course, recently bought, like, a day before the dish, fennel seed had a much more vibrant flavor than my, I guess, suppose now dead-tasting homegrown fennel seed. I'm going to scatter it in the garden. This year, a fennel plant came up, and it's extremely vigorous, but people walking by are wondering about it and picking all the leaves off. So it only has 2 flowers. I just checked yesterday, 2 flowers at the very top. Anyway, so you add 2 cups of broth, a heaping tablespoon of fennel seed, and 4 ounces of, which is probably about a half cup. I should have measured the volume, but I weighed 4 ounces of blanched almonds. And you let the chicken simmer gently for about a half an hour, maybe 35 minutes if they're big thighs. And that's it. Then you can let... I forgot a vital thing. The vital thing is when the chicken has brown, but not really. Sprinkle, I would move a few pieces over and sprinkle 2 tablespoons of flour in the bottom of the pan with the chicken and the onion and the pancetta. And you're making a little roux. So, you know, get some fat in there, you know, tilt the pan if you need to, cook the flour for a minute or two, and then add the two cups of broth and stir well so the flour roux mixes in with the broth, and now simmer for about a half an hour or 35 minutes, and then let it cool in the pan. It's delicious hot, but because I tasted it. Did I need to salt the chicken? I didn't, because my broth was salty. But do salt and pepper your chicken before browning it if you don't have an already very well-seasoned broth that you're cooking it in. And it was good hot, and then it was good when it cooled down. And then we weren't going to eat it until hours later, so I put it in the refrigerator, and it was thoroughly cooled. I wouldn't say it was deep chilled, but it was very cool and the perfect kind of thing for a hot summer day. If you cook it early in the morning or even the day before, if you're expecting, you know, a horrible, hot, humid day. So that was one of the old friends that I visited. I have not made the sfortamata yet. As I said, didn't want to turn on the oven. But one of the things that I came across the other day was like visiting an old friend. Went to Costco for the first time in 3 years, for obvious reasons. And actually, I had no intention of shopping in Costco, but Bob had to have new glasses made. And I must say, they have very good glasses and very inexpensive prices at Costco. Used to be you could go in and use the optometry department without being a member. Apparently now you need to be a member. So he became a member. I figured if he's a member, we might as well shop there. At least a little bit. And they do have very good fruit at Costco. And I was shocked to see that the tomato, the Cento tomatoes, San Marzano tomatoes that I like, were only in, for 3 cans, had only gone up $1. So it means they're now, what, $9, $10 for 3 cans. It's an amazing buy. And they do have good shrimp. They have a lot of good things at Costco. And they have a lot of good vegetables. So I'm going to do that. And now I forget why I was saying I went to Costco. Do you know?
No.
Ah, yes, I know. Because they have a good wine store. I just go in there to buy my whiskey. Not a lot of wine unless I see something, you know, something hits my eye. And something did hit my eye. And there was an old friend, Vouvray. I don't know if you're familiar with Vouvray, but it was a popular, I guess it was sort of popular in the 1970s when America was first starting to drink wine in any quantity, and the wine boom, they used to call it. And Chenin Blanc, the grape that Vouvray is made from, was a very popular California grape. But sweet. It made a sort of sweet wine. And Vouvray, which is, I think, the ultimate expression of Chenin Blanc, as the wine people would say, the ultimate expression, is, in fact, very often sweet. I think it's an exquisite sweet wine. The one that I bought at Costco, Barton and Guestier, I guess Guestier, you say, which is B&G, very, very, very famous wine house. Their Vouvray, Les Petits Parcelles, oh, it's made from small parcels of that they own, probably. Anyway, it is a bit sweet. And go online, it's very funny. By the way, this is the 2020 B&G Vouvray, made from Chenin Blanc. It is both off, I'd like to say off dry, but it also has high acidity, balancing out any residual sugar that's in the wine. I find it extremely refreshing. It is like a tropical wine. Has notes of pineapple. But when Bob doesn't drink, but he does smell wine and tell me what he smells. He's got a good smeller. And he said this one had a lot of pear. And in fact, that's one of the classic adjectives for Chenin Blanc. Is pear. He didn't know that, by the way, is that it has a pear bouquet. This one, I think, is pineapple-y. And on a hot day, as it was over the weekend, well-chilled, the tiny bit of sugar was refreshing with all that acidity, and pineapple-y and other tropical fruit aromas. I mean, you could make up a lot of things here. But it's fruity, flowery, a tad sweet, a tad, this one anyway. And it can be very sweet, and it should say sweet on the label. There'll even be ones that say dry, which are never... They may be dry, or they're certainly drier than this one, which doesn't make any claims at all. I don't think. No, it doesn't. I'm looking at the label. Oh, by the way, so this is an old friend. I used to drink Chenin Blanc. I used to drink Vouvray because I was a snob and didn't want the sweet Chenin Blanc from California, which came in big jugs. We're talking about the early 70s. And, you know, what were the wines that were popular then? That was when Riuniti Lambrusco, which is sweeter than any traditional Lambrusco. Riuniti is a brand name. That was popular. Matus, remember Matus?
Oh, yeah.
And Lancers. Well, Chenin Blanc from California was of the same period. But wine people will often tell you that when you start drinking wine, your taste is sweet. And then when you are finished drinking wine, your taste is sweet. Meaning, in between, you do the dry. And then you learn to appreciate the sweet, a good sweet wine. We're not talking Manischewitz. And in fact, I read this. Didn't know this, but I'm reading up on Chenin Blanc. I discovered that a couple of vintages ago, it was extremely late vintage, and the Chenin Blanc developed noble rot, which is a fungus that grapes get, and it concentrates the sugars, and you make super sweet dessert wines with it. For instance, Sauternes is good. Sauternes comes from grapes that have had noble rot. Anyway, summer friend, Vouvray. A bonus is it ends up not just at Costco, is it very inexpensive. I think it was $12. These days, if you can get something that's $12 or less, it's a steal. $13 is a good buy. $14, it's a nice wine. So I think you can get Vouvray's in the $10 to $14 category. I'm pretty sure. In fact, I know because I looked it up. So, and this is a 2020. There should be 2021 around. You know, white wine in general, you should drink younger rather than older. On the other hand, if you get a Vouvray that had noble rot and it's a sweet Vouvray, that ages very well. I don't know the chemistry of that. There is, I'm certain, there's a chemical answer to that. But so there we go, all my old friends. And are you doing? Are you eating anything special?
No, I made myself, for the first time, I made myself a very small quiche. I wanted to see if I could make a quiche.
Oh, and how'd it come out?
I left it in about 10 minutes too long. And so it came out a little dry. And but other than that, it was my first attempt.
A sausage. Did you follow a recipe?
I made it up as I went.
Well, I'm always stuck on, you know, the proportion of eggs to cream. I like Julia Child's proportions on that because you end up with a very creamy quiche, which is, you know, let me say, your first experience is often your standard, becomes your standard. So my first quiches were Julia Child's quiches, and so that's my standard. It's the same thing with the Italian food of my youth, which is all in Giuliano's book. By the way, Giuliano has sadly passed away. It's a number of years ago already. There's a lot of stuff in here. By the way, the original book, which came out in 1977, which is right after I met him, actually, because I probably met him in 75 or 4. That book has been republished in 1989 as a, what do they call it, updated and expanded. So, to add a little negativity to all this, Giuliano was very chauvinistic about Tuscan food, as was Marcella chauvinistic about her food, which was from Emilia-Romagna, up north. Tuscany is not north. So Tuscany, Florence is central Italy. Bologna is north. They both represented their cuisines as the cuisines of Italy. And neither was true, of course. It was Marcella who first started expounding that you should never put cheese on seafood or fish because the cheese of her region was Parmigiano, and that doesn't go on seafood or fish. Pecorino, sheep's milk cheeses, aged sheep's milk cheeses like they make in the South, that can be paired with fish or seafood or shellfish. Anyway, reading this book, I realized that, meaning the updated and expanded, somebody got to Giuliano and said, you know, you better include some baked ziti or something like that. Of course, he would never do but baked ziti. But in other words, there are dishes here that did not appear in the original book and are not representative of Tuscany at all. And Giuliano, being the chauvinist that he was, points this out every time the recipe is not his. Oh, well, they make this here or there, but not here. He'll say that sometimes. And Marcella was the same way. In fact, you know, I was friends with Marcella, and we went out to dinner one night here in Brooklyn. We went to Peter Luger. She loved Peter Luger. And she, all the way driving from my apartment to Peter Luger, she told me I was a fool for writing a book about Naples. That wasn't much of a cuisine, but Italians are like, I mean, Americans are like this. The only thing different is, and I've been thinking about this lately, Italians are hyper-regional and have only bad things to say. Not always, but usually have bad things to say about people from other regions. They even have negative nicknames for people from other regions. By the way, often with food, like, you know, in Neapolitans are macaroni eaters, Florentines are bean eaters, as if they ate nothing else. Anyway, this book has a lot of southern and northern, both recipes in it. So if you needed one basic cookbook, because I'm prejudiced, I would pick up the Bujali book as opposed to the Marcella Hazan book. Not to say Marcella doesn't have some good stuff in there, and I still do cook a lot of her recipes.
All right.
Yeah, anyway. Well, I'm going to eat something now. Now I'm hungry.
Enjoy your fourth.
Well, and you too, everybody. You know, let's try to be a little carefree today.
That's it. All right, Arthur.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Of course, you can find Arthur here live on the radio and also at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on Arthur Schwartz, the food maven.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Hillsdale Home Chef. More information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.